Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Bernard Connolly and Ira Harris. Bernard worked for many years in the European Commission, becoming head of the unit responsible for analysis of the European monetary system. The Wall Street Journal Europe named him as one of its outstanding Europeans of the year. 1995, Mark Carney, Governor of Bank of Canada, identified him as one of only a handful of economists to have accurately predicted the crisis. Derek Scott, economic advisor to Tony Blair, said of him that he understood the macroeconomic issues facing the world better than any economist on the planet. He is author of The Rotten Heart of Europe. And Ira is hedge fund manager, global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He served as CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hi, Richard.
Richard, thanks. Thanks for making this possible. This is a, you know, as I can't express my gratitude. Bernard has been just a phenomenal teacher for the world, but he certainly has taught me much. And I always tell people about the time I stood out in front of a Starbucks with Bernard for about 3 hours. It was one of the great symposiums I ever had, standing on the corner of in New York City. But it's emblematic of everything Bernard has meant to me. So standing on that corner with our coffee cups on the post. So let's continue from there.
Great. Maybe we can begin with the book, The Rotten Heart of Europe. Bernard, what was the message of that book, and how have you seen it evolve over the years? What are your thoughts on what has happened?
Well, I think the main message of the book was that the drive to European monetary union had little, if anything, to do with economics. It was entirely a political project intended to impose constraints and to create problems in the member countries of the union that would force them into a fiscal and political union. I think 5 years after the book was published, Romano Prodi, when he was president of the European Commission, said that the euro will create a crisis, and the crisis will allow us to do things that would otherwise have been impossible. And that, of course, is exactly how things have turned out. That for the first few years of the euro's existence, especially when Otmar Issing was in effect running the show in the ECB as the member of the board responsible for economics, they did attempt to run monetary policy as an arm of economic policy rather than as a tool of politics to core. From the mid-2000s, it became pretty obvious, and that it became even more obvious, of course, in the financial crisis and its aftermath, that everything to do with monetary union was political. It was intended to force people into an economic and monetary straitjacket unsuited to their circumstances, and to push people towards saying, well, we always used to say that you can't have the common market without a single market, you can't have the single market without a single currency, and the next step is to say you can't have the single currency without a single fiscal policy, and by the time you've got a single fiscal policy, effectively you've got a political union of a particularly objectionable sort, one in which there is no democratic control or accountability anywhere in the system. And that's what we've seen happen. Now, and I don't think anyone could deny that has been the case. It's there pretty much in black and white for everyone to see. Overlaid on that, there has been, and this was another message in the book in 1995, has been a rivalry between France and Germany for leadership, dominance, perhaps even domination of what this future political union was going to be. And again, in the first few years, the system was run essentially for the benefit of Germany, through a weak euro, which improved German competitiveness directly, and through the impact of monetary policy on creating unsustainable demand booms in the peripheral countries, which again were a powerful influence in supporting German exports. And the massive German export surplus, which built up during the course of the 2000s and has continued to be massive ever since, was of course very welcome to at least two elements of what I've called the permanent coalition in Germany. I don't mean a permanent coalition of political parties, I mean a permanent coalition of interests. Exporters, bankers, who were very pleased with the operation of monetary union in its first decade or so, as the German export surplus was recycled through lending to much of the rest of the European Union, created a lot of business and profitable opportunity for German banks. Many of those profits, of course, disappeared during the crisis, which is in itself was pretty much an inevitable consequence of the way that monetary union was being run. In the crisis itself and in its immediate aftermath up till 2012-13, let's say, German dominance in monetary union appeared to be even more complete through the imposition of extremely fierce, severe austerity on the countries which had accumulated, which had experienced boom bust, accumulated very substantial current account deficits. And in a sense, it's almost incredible that those countries put up with what they were forced to go through, say between 2009 and 2013 or so, but they did. And they did it not because their populations were happy about what was happening, but they did it because their governing elites, their bureaucratic, their academic, their business elites, were massively supportive of the idea of an undemocratic, unaccountable political union, which would inevitably enhance the power of elites, of what I've called a global European and indeed a global nomenclatura. People often use the phrase Davos man to identify that nomenclatura. Since in the past few years, things have changed quite dramatically and gone in the opposite direction, with the debtor countries having gained control of the ECB, in fact, with the compliance of Angela Merkel, who was, I think, as we're starting to see, was an absolutely disastrous German chancellor in all sorts of ways. And the ECB has become pretty much a tool of the French government rather than of the German government. The ECB's president, of course, is French. More importantly, alliances have been forged on the ECB Council, which has allowed France and its allies to overwhelm opposition from the Bundesbank, from the Dutch Central Bank, and from some of the Baltic central banks, to the extent that the ECB continues to press its foot down on the accelerator, even though inflation has reached 5%. Now, come one draw up a balance sheet. In economic terms, the monetary union contributed to a boom bust. It contributed to the immiserization of some of the southern European countries after an initial illusory feeling that they were getting richer. It's contributed that the level of the euro is still something that is in the perceived interest of Germany as well as of France, but it has meant that the euro is dramatically undervalued as Germany's currency. It's maybe roughly fairly valued as Italy's or France's. It's overvalued still as the currency of some of the other southern European states. In total, it has meant that the euro area has accumulated a very substantial, in aggregate, very substantial export surplus. And that's been one of the most important elements of international disequilibrium in the world. I stress international, you know, I think the intertemporal disequilibrium is even greater, and perhaps something we'll come on to later in this podcast. In political terms, there's no doubt whatsoever that monetary union is achieving its objective of producing a totally undemocratic, unaccountable, and essentially anti-freedom political conglomeration. So I'd say that both on the economic side, but domestically, if I can use that term, of the euro area as a whole, and internationally, and on the political side, again, domestically, because it increases the power of Davos man, whether Davos man is a politician, a bureaucrat, a financier, a businessman. And internationally, it's very striking that Davos man globally has been very, very much in favor of European Monetary Union, of European Union more generally. Now, there's no mystery in that. Davos man doesn't like accountability, doesn't like democracy, doesn't like freedom, doesn't like competition. And the European Union has essentially become an anti-competitive device as well as an anti-democratic device. So overall, I think it has been a disaster for Europe. It has been a disaster for the world, and it still is a disaster both for Europe and for the world.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
So, I mean, Bernard lays it out, and I know we'll go because where do we look at from here? So, and what, you know, Lagarde, President, ECB President Lagarde has such a stake in this because, of course, she was the IMF director through that period that Bernard brings us through until her appointment as the ECB president. So now she continues to proceed along this line, and the massive buildup of the ECB balance sheet, which is it so big now, and its impact upon the world because of the debt structure of it, that it can't be broken out. And can't be broken apart. And Germany, as Bernard points out, and what the media is now grabbed onto, the old phrase of the Hanseatic Five, so to speak, although every time Lagarde has a press conference, no matter how much criticism there may have been at the ECB board meeting, at the press conference, of course, everything gets... is sanguine, but now we have a new head of the Bundesbank as Jens Wiedmann has stepped down, and Nagel is in place with the finance minister in Germany, of Lindner, who's a little bit different than what we've seen, although prior to that, of course, we have seen Wolfgang Schäuble. But so, Bernard, of course, the question becomes, without the German guarantee of the ECB balance sheet, what does the world look like? Where do we go? Because as I see it, how can European rates, and I don't care how much the ECB buys, and as Jerome Powell once said to me, Bernard, I think you and I talked about this, I was at a symposium where he was speaking in Chicago, and I can tell you the date of it, June 27, 2016, it was the Monday after Brexit. And I asked him very directly, who guarantees the ECB balance sheet? In which, now he wasn't Fed chair yet, but he was certainly a Fed governor, in which he did not blink for a minute and said, they have a printing press. And it was so disarming to me, because the ECB only with a printing press is not a very good thing politically or economically. So there has to be a guarantee of that debt. So in this world, to me, if Germany were to, you know, as, and I know you've written about it so much years ago, that if Germany were to have the Deutschmark and everybody else were to have the euro, what would the global financial system, what would be the outcome for that, for the global financial system, especially in the short term?
Well, there are two different questions. What would it have liked if there had always been a Deutschmark on the one hand and all the others in the euro on the other hand? But I guess your question is not about that. It's what would happen if somehow Germany were suddenly or over a period of time no longer in the euro area.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, the... if for the moment we could park some of the dynamics, the comparative statics outcome would be that the German currency would be a lot stronger than it is, the euro would be massively weaker than it is. I think we'd see on impact pretty much within a few days, the rump euro, if I can call it that, go down to about 80 cents against the dollar. But we can't ignore the dynamics, and it would be a chaotic situation. The debt in the rump euro area could then, as Jerome Powell said, only be sustained through the printing press. And the impact of that would be to drive the euro down even further. And one could very quickly get into sort of, you know, Indonesia in 1998 territory. But Indonesia in 1998 was not a major factor in the global economy. The euro area, even without Germany, still would be a very major factor in the global economy. And the global impact of a plummeting euro would be extremely significant and extremely adverse. And we quite probably drive us quickly into a regime of capital controls and trade restrictions. Globally, as well, of course, as creating enormous strains in the financial system in Europe and again in the world. So it's a pretty alarming prospect. The alternative isn't all that much better. I mean, the alternative is a continuation of the credit bubble that Mario Draghi created in 2012 with his whatever it takes speech. And a credit bubble will eventually burst as the size of the bubble gets bigger And the number of people prepared to invest in the bubble, if I can use that phrase, gets smaller. And demographics, apart from anything else, indicate that the number of people likely to invest in that credit bubble is going to get smaller. The bubble, of course, is getting bigger. And there is a real risk of a very substantial collapse at some point. Now, at some point is not a very useful phrase from an investor's, and even less from a trader's point of view. But if one's trying to map out the path ahead, I think one can use it and say that this thing is going to come apart. And it will come apart in extremely unfavorable circumstances, both for Europe and for the world. So again, it's a pretty depressing prospect, I have to say. It's not the only depressing prospect in the world, and perhaps that's something that you, Richard, or Ira might want to come on to, but it's certainly a very dangerous element of the global economic, financial, and for that matter, political situation. That's even without adding in geopolitics and the risks associated with the European Union's relations with Russia and its relations with China, both of which are leading to considerable tension within the bloc, and also between the bloc and the United States, and to some extent Britain. So this podcast is entitled Financial Repression, what's the A stand for?
Authority.
I remember.
Yeah.
Authority. The ECB and also, unfortunately, the Fed are certainly members of that financial repression authority. And together, as I said, the European situation is a scary one. It's a dangerous one, but it's only part of an even bigger and even scarier and more dangerous global picture.
So we come back to financial repression, and as I when I blog about in Notes from Underground, which I don't do as much as I have, I enjoy doing these podcasts, but I discussed that there's nobody financially repressed right now more than the Germans. Now, The retort, of course, will be, yes, but they, as you point out, they've gotten the benefit of a much weaker currency in which to sustain their current account surpluses and certainly balance of trade surpluses, that when you look at their current account, on a per capita basis, it's bigger than China's, and not by a small amount. So they've certainly benefited. And as you pointed out—
Well, Ira, could I just interrupt? So we'd say they've benefited. It's hard to say that Germany has benefited. It's certainly not the case, I think, that the average German saver or taxpayer has benefited. It has benefited a corporatist bureaucratic elite. And that is a very different thing. But sadly, I come back to saying the whole point of, or a very considerable part of the point of European monetary union was precisely to buttress the power, the privileges, the perks, the wealth, the prosperity of that corporatist elite, vis-a-vis the people. And, you know, referring to anyone who complains about that as populist, as some sort of dreadful insult, is of course the first resort of the elites. But I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No. So that takes us to good point from several points. So right, I think that's absolutely right. And at what point will there be pushback? Well, there has been pushback, although the fall of the AFD was quicker. You know, they looked like they were ascending, especially when they were being run by in 2013-14 when it was the economists at the forefront of the AFD, and then of course they got sidetracked by other issues, just like the Tea Party did in the United States, where it was the Tea Party had its massive faults, but it attracted, as once these groups get traction, they attract a lot of people who have all types of issues, and then they get sidetracked. So, yeah. but that being so, it's only gotten worse, of course, because you know people look, you know, and I could sit here and I run the numbers 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 times a day, and you look at the European sovereign debt tenures, those who are members of the 19 of the ECB. And you go, okay, well, at least France is now 25 basis points positive on the 10-year. Mm-hmm. And I laugh at it because then I go look at the 2-year yield and the French 2-year note is negative 60. The German Schatz is negative 60. You know, it's just preposterous. These numbers, yeah. They don't mean a thing except for the pain that they're causing somebody, because somebody will pay for this. But it does bring that issue, and I know your stance because with Brexit. But if we go back to Brexit and the as you've criticized the FT for so many years, and it's far worse now because many of the writers who I used to look to at the FT are long gone, and it's just a house organ of what you call Davos, man, there's no question about it. And they're still trying to bring back the Remain camp. But the one issue that seems to lose out is that when the Brits were able to remove themselves, they no longer have any responsibility for the cost of what may happen when the ECB suffers the tremors that they will, and again, who's gonna guarantee the ECB balance sheet? Well, certainly not the Brits, right? They're mm-hmm. now out. They have no responsibility whatsoever. And that savings has to be far more enormous than anything that they could possibly garner in a positive fashion mm-hmm. from the EU. Am I wrong in that?
The savings
Fiscal responsibility that the Brits have no fiscal responsibility for what is the ECB balance sheet. And the reason I say that, somebody I know, I think that you used to be pretty fond of, Otmar Issing, wrote an op-ed mm-hmm. About 3 or 4 years ago in the FT, in which he said, it was interesting that Issing wrote it, no taxation without representation. And when you really look at the EC balance sheet, that is taxation without representation, because as you pointed out many times, that in order for Europe to exist, it's going to have to become a transfer union. Well, a transfer union is nothing but a taxing, is nothing but a fiscal authority. So, but the Brits have now got themselves out from under that responsibility.
Yes, I mean, there are one or two nuances about the EIB, but basically, yes, that's correct. That Britain won't be on the hook for what goes wrong in the euro area. Whether the world as a whole will feel that it has to bail out the euro area is a different matter. And we can't rule out that possibility, but certainly, as a first stage, Britain no longer has any responsibility, and that means the burden on Germany, the Netherlands, will be somewhat bigger than otherwise.
So I mean, there's just no escaping it, and somebody. You know, I know that Lagarde was put in for her political acumen far more than her. She didn't have the financial authority that Draghi brought to himself, which was kind of interesting because I thought he was certainly not the best choice, but I understood the politics of the choice. But it keeps getting back to us and back to, and the debt load that gets taken on through Teltro and every other program, and the fact that the that the ECB believes that it's going to be able to separate itself from the rest of the world, because just in case we actually got into some sense of the removal of QE, again, the attempt to shrink the bank balance sheets that have been built up, they think they're going to be able to sustain their present position far longer, which of course basically keeps, although we haven't seen that of late, downward pressure on the euro, or at least keeps it stable, right? Almost like, okay. But when you really look at it, because of the sense of financial repression and everything that comes with it, the increasing amount of debt that is taken on through so many different entities and entities that the central banks don't even monitor, again, brings us back to 2007, 2008, when it was the shadow bank, so to speak. So there's just so much, and they think that they can sustain it. I can't believe it whatsoever. I mean, people are sleepwalking through it because, as you say, well, there's a party going on, right? When somebody's financially repressed, that means somebody's being financially rewarded. It's probably the state and, of course, large asset holders and those who have savings of any caliber, as Issing talked about. But we get into this mindset, Bernard, and it must plague you at times, where in the United States, when they were busy financially repressing the hell out of savers, and there were comments to the, about, well, people were, writing letters to the Fed back in 2012 and 13, and then even more. And when then Yellen takes over, and people were writing letters going, hey, I'm a saver, I'm getting killed here. What about me? And the response was from Bernanke, and I'm paraphrasing somewhat, but probably quoting, stop crying, stop complaining. Your stock portfolios are going up, your home is going up, and your children and grandchildren have jobs that they're getting from, what we're doing with the economy. So stop your crying. And it seems to be
the ECB and Carney, when he was governor of the Bank of England, had said pretty much exactly the same things.
Yeah, and I thought he was really good at the Bank of Canada, but I think he was way over his head. But I know Mervyn King was a far stronger, Carney was just all over the place. But it's that mindset, and Lagarde's in the same mindset too. She almost uses the same words verbatim, which is scary. Stop your complaining. Stop. The Germans should stop complaining about how badly financially repressed they are, and just enjoy that the rest of Europe is doing well.
Well, that doesn't go down particularly well with the German saver. We've had a period of a couple of years, as you said, and AfD didn't disappear from the political scene, but became a much less important influence. But with very high rates of German inflation, admittedly, the 12-month rate comes down because of base level effects and all the rest of it. The very high rates of inflation in Germany, negative interest rates. There's clearly a pathway for some political figure, whether an existing or a new one, to start concentrating people's minds on that. Now, for the past couple of years, it has overwhelmed everything. But let's hope that we're coming out of at least the pandemic phase of COVID, and other concerns will come back to the fore. The expropriation of German savers is bound to become a much more important political issue again. We're starting to see it already in the comments made by the new Bundesbank president. But Weidmann made similar comments that it didn't make much difference. The question now is, if the coalition in the ECB continues to overrule the Hanseatic Five, or however one wants to call them, what political impact is that going to have in those five countries? But I think the long and the short of it is that, unfortunately, unless there is some sort of major populist revolt, nothing's going to change. And things will carry on their present course. During the referendum campaign, the Brexit referendum campaign in Britain, there was the Project Fear, which said that unemployment would go up 500,000 within a few weeks of Brexit, everything would collapse. And that was nonsense, of course. But there's a Project Fear about the breakup of the euro, which is more substance to it. And the substance is that if the euro were to break up, there would be financial chaos and quite probably financial collapse in a significant number of euro area countries. The least bad option would be for Germany to withdraw. That's always been the case, of course. It would be the least bad option because people would not want to get rid of new Deutschmarks or whatever the currency was called. They want to hold it because they know that the German's currency has been undervalued. The rump euro would collapse in value. And as we discussed before, the impact of that, both domestically and globally, would be very dangerous. But it would be less dangerous than the breakup of the euro area or a withdrawal by some of the weaker countries in the euro area. But the least bad is still pretty awful. There's no getting away from that. The least for whom? The least bad for the world. But there are some people who, as you've indicated, are doing fantastically well out of financial repression. And they tend to be the people who have the political power. And democracy, as well as prosperity and stability, are in danger as a result of that constellation of circumstances.
Yeah, Bernard, if I can. So last week or 2 weeks ago, I saw a story that really caught my eye. That the Bundesbank still exchanges people's Deutschmarks for euros, which was interesting. I mean, that's still going on, where it ended, I believe, in 2002 or 2003 for most other countries in Europe. So if you were a French person who had francs, you could only exchange them for euros up to a certain, there was a drop dead date. But now, I mean, the Bundesbank is still, so I was going to take out an ad for people who still had Deutschmarks in their mattresses, you know, because how many people realize that they still are exchanging? So it caught my eye because I go, wow, that's still going on, which means, and there's not a small amount that gets exchanged. I think it's like 2 or 3 billion annually, which is an amazing, amazing thing. That far into this I still want to call it an experiment, but we're beyond the experiment stage. I mean, I still keep the Deutschmark. I'm going to my screen right here. I mean, I can tell you that the traditional Deutschmark is, at today's level of the euro, 171. And interesting what you talk about with Brexit, where so many of the Davos crowd were so wrong, but they wanted everybody to panic and be wrong about what the outcomes would be. And that's going from the United States president to others about going to the end of the queue. But the euro sterling, which depreciated in the face of all that, and is really still about 15 to 16 to 17% lowered from just before the Brexit vote has served Britain pretty well, because because it's not a weak sterling based on inflation or anything negative. It was based on the mindset that it was going to be all over for Britain. And it's weakened the currency. And I think that people really fail to understand that that has aided and abetted Britain in a very positive way, because a lot of, I think, global capitalists who were using Britain, especially as an automobile platform to manufacture cars and then export them throughout Europe, they had to be careful about the exchange issue, and just to pull up stakes out of the UK would not have served them well. So the market did work.
Yeah, I mean, well, a couple of points. That's that 12 to 15% persisting depreciation against the euro is massively more important for car manufacturers than the current level of tariffs, or there aren't any at the moment, but the level of tariffs that would have obtained if there'd been no deal whatsoever. And second, sterling was hugely overvalued in the middle of the third quarter of 2015. My calculations at the time suggested that, you know, just using the dollar as a benchmark and holding the dollar conceptually constant against the rest of the world, that an equilibrium level for sterling would have been about 24% lower than it actually was in the middle and third quarter of 2015. That has largely been corrected.
Okay.
Not wholly, and there's still a current account deficit larger than I think can be warranted by future prospects. But the depreciation of sterling since the, which began towards the end of 2015, was massively accelerated by Brexit, has undoubtedly been a good thing for the British economy. There's no doubt whatsoever about that.
And I just wanted to ask, so overall, in terms of a European bond integrating a fiscal union in the EMU, what is your assessment overall, short-term, medium-term, of that likelihood potential?
Short-term is low, I think. I think the German authorities made it pretty clear when the European Recovery Fund, or whatever it was called, was established, that this was one-off related to the COVID pandemic, was not going to develop into a bond union. I think it would be hard for, especially in the current circumstances of inflation, it's going to be hard for the German government to go back on that in the short term. Medium to longer term, it absolutely has to happen, unless Germany decides that, well, we dislike this European bond so much that we're going to leave. And things have got to get a lot worse economically, or perhaps I should say a lot better politically in Germany, in terms of the state of German politics and the relationship of the German government to voters, before that can happen. But it's one thing or the other. And there has to be, in the medium to longer term, joint European bonds. Eventually, all the bonds would have to be European bonds, or the thing would break up in one way or another. So short term, I don't think it's going to happen. Long term, it will happen unless there's a breakup. And which of those two alternatives happens is going to be largely a factor of internal German politics and the way that German politics and German democracy evolve over the next few years.
Bernard, but it's okay. So, and Richard, that's a great question. I'm glad you brought it up, because then we go back to, and I thought it was a very telltale spot in May of 2020, when Wolfgang Schäuble was still, well, he's the president of the Bundestag. But over that weekend, when they went to that, when COVID was really, and Schäuble came out in favor, surprised me. It was over the Memorial Day holiday in the U.S. And I can tell you the euro was trading about 108. And Schäuble makes the comment that it's better to create those pandemic bonds to transfer money around to those in hardship, because and he cited Italy, that if you only, you know, because those who wanted to create loans, Schäuble made the comment, if you create loans, it's like giving them stones. Whereas if you create transfers, it's giving them bread, which mm-hmm. coming from Schäuble was, but I said, wow, this is a sea change. And maybe we're going to see the beginnings of a euro bond. And it actually made me bullish the euro, and the euro did rally.
It did indeed. So I did appreciate, yeah. As the risk, which is no doubt pretty low even before those comments, and of a euro breakup was diminished to, for the then foreseeable future, to virtually zero. Inevitably, when you take out that risk of a breakup, and everyone knows if the euro broke up in one way or another, the euro would likely be very substantially weak. You take out that risk, or you defer that risk, the currency appreciates, which it did. And I think what Schäuble was saying was, well, first of all, he was making it pretty clear that this was a pandemic thing. And in a sense, you can view that European Recovery Fund as being the equivalent of furlough payments in Britain or the US, where because of an act of God, one can say, lots of people were prevented from pursuing economic activity. They were going to be made dramatically poorer. There'd be a great deal of hardship. There had to be a degree of solidarity in sharing that pain. The pain has been borne almost entirely by savers, of course, rather than taxpayers so far. And that maybe that, again, is something we can come back to. But within the EU, had there not been that degree of, quote, solidarity, unquote, the politics of maintaining the euro area, and for that matter, the European Union, would have become very difficult. In countries like Italy and a number of others, to keep the euro together, they had to do it. Now, can they keep the euro together for a few more years without going further and having a European bond? Probably. Can they do it many years? No, absolutely not. And again, this dreadful phrase, at some point, comes in. At some point, will there be a European bond? Well, not in the next couple of years, in my view. Subsequently, there has to be, or the thing breaks up. And forgive me for repeating myself, but which of those two alternatives is chosen is going to depend on, how can I put it, the progress of populism versus the nomenclatura in Germany and in other European countries. By the way, one of the things that may affect that, the nomenclatura has always pointed to the existence of an external threat to dampen opposition. Now, is the Ukraine going to play that role? Is the German cozying up to Russia going to create problems with other members? Is the Italian cozying up to China going to create problems? One can't leave geopolitics out of these equations, because there is still not a unitary European state. The individual states still matter. That clouds the picture, but you know, peering into this murkers as far as I can, I repeat that I don't think we're going to see a European bond in the next couple of years. Unless the crisis comes very much further, and by the crisis, I mean the debt crisis comes very much further. And that means that, in a sense, to hold off a European bond, the ECB has got to continue with its pedal on the accelerator. And it may be that ultimately the people who count in Germany, the people who count in the Bundesbank, view inflation as less of a threat politically in Germany than the risk of a debt union. It may be. As far as the Bundesbank's concerned, I'd be surprised. I think they see inflation as more of a threat than a debt union. They see both of them as very unpleasant threats. But for the German establishment as a whole, I think inflation is seen as less of a, not that I think there won't be inflation, but they see the threat posed by inflation as being less than the threat to their control of the German establishment posed by a debt union. Now, they may be wrong in that judgment. People often make decisions which they think are in their own interests and they don't turn out to be. But that's my current reading of the political situation.
But you know, and you, as always, raised great points on the geopolitical. And the one thing that seems to continue to perplex me is that in this discussion about the, you know, of course, each nation state within the European Union, which is still a difficult mechanism to place together, Gerhard Schroeder gets no play here. But meanwhile, he runs right Gazprom. And I always look at Schroeder as more than interesting because, and I know how much he wrote about this back in the early aughts, but Schroeder called an election that he didn't have to call after he was having great success with Hartz IV the German unions understood what was going on with the freeing of Eastern Europe and who was most vulnerable. But Schroeder being the chairman of Gazprom, I mean, imagine that George W. Bush had taken a job with the people's somewhere in China or in Russia after he left the White House.
Yeah,
we would be aghast. And yet, and Schroeder is still a power, from what I understand, within the Social Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. So you can't, I mean, the politics get deeper and deeper as to what Germany really wants here, I think, you know, and yet it gets very little play in the discussion.
What Germany and what Germans want. I mean, recent opinion polls and, you know, discussions with German friends suggest that Germans want a close relationship with Russia. And that, you know, in some ways, the German mindset is now closer to the Russian mindset than to the mindset of what we can call the rest of the West. And it's interesting with what German reunification did wasn't to create a bigger West Germany, which a lot of people thought would happen at the time. It was to change Germany radically and fundamentally. And the sort of, you know, the Bonn Republic, the Rhineland Republic, the Rhenish model, the very significant influence of Catholicism in West Germany. Well, that's all gone along with West Germany. We are now back with a German mindset, which is again turning to the East. What that means for monetary union is quite hard to sort out. I think one of the things it means is that Macron is pushing his luck a bit too far. And if he tries too hard to grasp control of the European Union from Germany, then Germany's eastward look will be accentuated. And that really does increase the possibility of a breakup, not just of the monetary union, but of the European Union as a whole. And Macron has been very silly in his Anglophobe stance at the moment. The more that Germany closes up to Russia, the more important it is for there to be a strong European element of the of NATO, and the more important it is for Anglo-French military cooperation to continue. And Macron is putting that at risk through his blatantly Anglophobe attitudes. Lots of balls up in the air, as always.
Yeah, more so now it appears, especially because Ukraine is on the bubble and Putin is, you know, he is a grand chess player. He's got, you know, big things in his mindset. And I find it, you know, people are getting nervous, but rightfully so, because the last two moves by Putin, interestingly, which was in South Ossetia and Georgia in the summer of 2008, came during the Beijing Olympics. And then the move on Crimea came during the Sochi Olympics. Well, here we are at the Beijing, where we're coming back to the Chinese Winter Olympics in less than 30 days. So, there is a pattern here. I don't know whether he's going to continue the pattern. I think he's trying. To me, he wants to get in writing, unlike what they got in 1991 that Margaret Thatcher so beautifully warned everybody about anyway, with the unification of Germany. But he wants in writing certain agreements from US or NATO that there will be no further expansion. And I believe that Zbigniew Brzezinski warned about this initially. In fact, I went back and read some of his articles from 91, that this was going to be an issue and how far did you want to go? Now, I found the Finns interesting because the Finnish were making noise last week that they have a right to belong to NATO. And my sense is, when you look at it legally, you don't have a right, it's a privilege. And if NATO grants you that privilege, that's one thing. But at what cost is it, what you perceive to be a right, is it to the rest of the world? Or maybe NATO is just over and the whole concept of collective action clauses and everything that comes with it. But to me, Putin is really, he's got his eye on bigger things here than just Ukraine is a convenience.
Yes, I think, and it's widely recognized, that's been for a long time. His aim is, as a minimum, to recreate the Tsarist Empire, to reintegrate the Ukraine, the Baltic states, part of Russia, probably Finland. And, well, who knows? Parts of Poland.
Okay.
But, you know, so it's NATO's interest to allow Finland, Ukraine into the organization. Difficult question. You know, on the one hand, when you are confronted with someone who is a combination of gambler and master strategist, as Putin is, you're taking the risk that if you let them in and then he attempts to take over Finland, that either you activate the collective clause 5 of the NATO treaty or you don't. And no one wants to have to activate it. No one wants for it to be shown to be a paper tiger. On the other hand, if you don't let them in, does that embolden Putin to just take over anyway? Then you push the question one frontier back. You know, is it Sweden? Is it Poland? Is it Lithuania? It's a very, very difficult choice to make. And my guess is, and I'm by no means an expert in these matters, I'm not really following it closely, but my guess is that NATO will try to will agree that Ukraine will not become that Ukraine, I beg its pardon. They get very agitated if you say the Ukraine still, that Ukraine will not be admitted to NATO, and that Finland will be discouraged from making an application. Is that the right choice? I don't know. But my guess is that tomorrow's risk is something you are about to worry about tomorrow, and today's risk is something you worry about today. And the bigger risk, it will be seen as having these countries in NATO, and yet, and then Putin trying to call your bluff about Clause 5.
Interesting. And just a last topic of discussion. Bernard, can you elaborate on the concept of intellectual failure and how central may be inadvertently destroying capitalism?
Well, the intellectual failure is essentially one of academics, of academic macroeconomists. Constructed a stripped down, completely unrealistic model of the way that capitalist economies work. And it's stripped down and unrealistic because it completely fails to understand the nature of capitalism. And what drives capitalism is entrepreneurship. And entrepreneurship involves both risk and uncertainty. It involves, or it should involve, financial failure for those who get it wrong and financial success for those who get it right. And failing to understand that has led to an equal failure to understand the relationship between investment and productivity, and this becomes very important. In the model, to the extent that capital appears at all, it is just, in the symbol delta K, it is an accretion of the capital stock. In the real world, it's an act of entrepreneurship associated with risk and uncertainty. And when an entrepreneur comes up with a new idea, whether it's a new process or a new product or a totally different way of looking at things, yes, he's taking a risk. But for that new process or new idea or new product to increase the productive capacity of the economy, he's first got to invest in it. He's got to, in a rather old-fashioned language, he's got to build a new factory or do the equivalent inside the technology of building a factory. You've got to invest in it. And what that investment does in the short to medium term, the medium term is probably about maybe 5 years in this context, is to increase the level of demand relative to the level of aggregate supply in the economy. When the new factory or the new cyber system or whatever is installed and completed, then productive potential goes up just at the point at which that investment is finished. So you're no longer doing the investment. You've got the new supply capacity. So you get a big swing in the balance between supply and demand. In the heroic phase, if you like, when heroic entrepreneurs are making their bets and installing their new capacity, adding to demand, adding to supply, you've got an excess, if nothing else happens, if policy doesn't change, an excess of aggregate demand over aggregate supply. When it's been installed, and historically, bursts of activity, you know, innovations are bunched together. They're not evenly spread out to, in a continuous flow over time. You get bursts of activity, strong levels of investment, very favorable entrepreneurial expectations, very favorable consumer and household expectations when they start to read all the news stories about these wonderful new things that are happening. And then it tails off. And the initial excess of aggregate demand over aggregate supply is reversed. Supply has got productive potential. Potential supply has gone up because all these things, all these projects are now bearing fruit. Aggregate demand, other things being equal, has gone down because you're no longer doing the investment. And you get a huge swing, which monetary policy has to cope with. And the way to cope with it is to ensure that in the initial phase, when entrepreneurial expectations are very strong, the anticipated rate of return on investment is very high, then the ex ante real interest rate also has to be very high. And you defer demand into the period when additional supply is available. And when that supply is available, investment demand weakens, you reduce interest rates and allow that previously deferred demand, household demand, consumption demand to come through and take up the additional supply that's being created by the investment. Now, that's how it should work. If you have a model that ignores entrepreneurship, uncertainty, risk, if you have a model that gets the relationship between productivity and investment the other way around, essentially the standard macro models that central banks use say that productivity leads to higher investment rather than the other way around, in which investment with a lag leads to higher productivity. If you get those things wrong, and the standard macroeconomic model did get them wrong, and why it did is I'll come back to in a moment, then you have a view like Greenspan's in the mid-90s, in which all credit to him, he spotted that something was happening in the economy a lot sooner than most other economists, most other policymakers. He spotted that productivity was going to improve and actually started improving. But his conclusion was that this means that you can have lower unemployment and lower interest rates without inflation because productivity improvements are going to produce lower inflation and allow you to have lower interest rates during that process. And he persistently held off raising interest rates in the second half of the 90s, despite initially a lot of opposition from the FOMC, where a lot of people said, for heaven's sake, what's going on? The unemployment rate is falling below the Naira. We're going to get inflation. They were wrong in that inflation didn't happen, and it didn't happen because over time the level of productivity started moving up. But they were right in thinking the policy should have been tighter at the beginning of that process. Not because I think they understood the underlying processes, but just because they had a Naira model in their mind. and actual unemployment was going lower than what they thought the Nauru was. But Greenspan just batted away this these requests from the FMC, or not the FMC as a whole, but from many individual FMC members for higher interest rates. And most damagingly of all, after, you remember, I certainly remember the sort of mini financial panic, the mini financial crisis in the summer and autumn of 1998, with the Asian crisis, Korea, Russia, long-term, LTMC, was it? LTCM, long-term capital management. There was something like the beginning of what we saw in the autumn of 2007, when the stock market plummeted, credit spreads started moving up, liquidity started to disappear. And the Fed cut interest rates three times in a short period and restored confidence. And it was fairly easy to restore confidence then because the sums involved were pretty small. I think the bailout of LTCM was something like $1 billion, which looked like a big number at the time, but was tiny compared with those in play in 2007, 2008. But then instead of taking back those interest rate reductions, Greenspan just sat on things for another year until inflation expectations started moving up, long-term rates started moving up. And it was the rise in long-term rates that eventually forced Greenspan into starting a new hiking cycle towards the end of 1999, just when it was too late. It was too late because we were then, you know, approaching the end of what I call this medium term of 5 years, that period of extremely buoyant entrepreneurial expectations. And what got into around about the middle of 2000, I think, it was almost as if corporate CEOs had sort of collectively got out of bed one morning and thought, oh my God, who are we going to sell all this new stuff to that we're capable of producing? And the answer was, we don't know. Maybe we can't. And there was a collapse in entrepreneurial expectations, which quite soon translated into a potential collapse in demand in the United States. And the Fed, at the end of 2000, suddenly went from having a tightening bias to into reducing interest rates and following that up very quickly with a series of emergency cuts. In a sense, that was necessary to prevent what, in the event, turned out to be a very mild or hardly discernible recession in the United States, to prevent that from becoming a very substantial recession. But it was at the cost of enshrining that they got the sequence of interest rates wrong. They were too low in the mid-90s, they were too high in 1999. They had to crash them down again. And in crashing them down again, they were just deferring the possibility or the probability of future recession. Because the further you reduce the real interest rate below normal, and I think almost all macroeconomists agree that normal means the rate of household time preference, which doesn't change very much. The more you reduce real interest rates below the rate of time preference, the more you are going to pre-program a downward trend, downward future trend in demand relative to potential output. Now, how does that, where do I get the idea that interest rates below the rate of time preference must mean that future consumption growth is less than future income growth, and hence you get a recession? Well, it's it just drops out of the mathematics of the so-called Euler equation for consumption. That the intuition is that if you spend more today, you've got to spend less tomorrow. And it's as simple as that, if income is. If the expected path of income is unchanged, the more you spend today, the less there is to spend tomorrow. With a caveat, except in Keynesian conditions, where people spend less than is justified because they're worried about whatever that everyone else is going to be spending less. But those conditions aside, the more you spend today, the less you can spend tomorrow. Now, unless your expectations of future income are distorted upwards, or you are given incentives not to care about paying your debts. And essentially, that's what the Fed policy did, both of those things. By reducing interest rates, it drove up asset prices. It took a while after 2000, but eventually it came and then it accelerated. Driving up asset prices gives people the illusion of wealth. You think, oh, my house is worth more, my shares are worth more, I'm richer, the economy is richer. I can continue to consume at my present rate. I don't have to worry that I might be spending too much because, you know, I can just cash in all these gains. So policy created the illusion of wealth. It also created the illusion, or perhaps it's an illusion, who knows, that debt doesn't matter, I never have to pay my debts. Again, in technical terms, it turned off the transversality constraint, which again is another fancy way of saying that if you have debt today, you've got to have surpluses in the future to pay it off. And those two phenomena, the illusion of wealth and the illusion that debts never have to be repaid, have been disastrous both economically and much more so politically. Disastrous economically in that the longer you pursue those policies, the lower the rate of productivity growth is likely to be, and that's certainly been the case over the long haul since about 2003 in the United States and more generally in the world. And politically, it gives power and wealth to the nomenclatura, including the banking nomenclatura, which we saw in the years leading up to the crisis. Now, the crisis was merely an interruption of these trends. In fact, the trends have become even more pronounced in the wake of the 2007-2008 financial crisis. Now, that solidified the power of the nomenclatura. It's produced massive inequalities in wealth and to some extent in income. Now, the inequalities in income were somewhat ameliorated during the Trump presidency, but the inequalities in wealth got even bigger. And the impact of that is now seen in surveys in the United States and in almost all advanced countries, where popular support for capitalism, particularly among the young, has plummeted. I think polls are suggesting that more than half of people aged less than 34 in the United States prefer socialism to capitalism. And we have got ourselves into a state where the only way of keeping the show on the road has been to exacerbate the perceived inequality, well, the actual inequalities and the perceived inequities in the system, and to weaken support for capitalism, to weaken support for free markets, and to increase support for socialism and Marxism, even communism. Mm-hmm. We In a sense, both the election of Trump in 2016 and Brexit in Britain were a protest by a lot of ordinary people against what they saw as the system being rigged against them for the benefit of Davos Man or of a nomenclatura. Now, in the United States, as I suggested, maybe income equality was moderated a little bit during Trump's presidency, but overall, we can hardly claim that the Trump presidency was a triumph for free market thinking, was a triumph for liberal capitalism. It certainly didn't create an upsurge in support for capitalism and free markets, if anything, rather the opposite. And in Britain, the government, and certainly the civil service, the non-governmental organizations, the broadcasting media, and the rest of the nomenclatura have fought very hard and so far successfully. The civil service, at any rate, when I say the government, I mean the civil service, fought very successfully to prevent the greater freedom given by Brexit to be used to foster free markets, to foster a liberal capitalist economy. There's been very little progress whatsoever. Perhaps things haven't got worse in Britain in that respect since Brexit, but they've not got a great deal better, and it's hard to see mm-hmm. how they're going to get better under the present management. That's that opens up a whole different set of questions. But to summarize, the model used by almost all central banks is convenient for central banks because it allows them to say that anything that goes wrong is a result of a so-called stochastic disturbance, not of anything that has gone wrong in previous monetary policy. And stochastic disturbances right themselves over time. It may take a while, but they do. And the system is ultimately self-normalizing. And it's convenient for the economics industry. Because, you know, essentially, if you look at what is the sort of holy writ of the macroeconomics industry, that's Michael Woodford's 2003 book, Interest and Prices, still. This model comes down to, to four simple equations. And you, in elaborating on manipulating, extending, debating the parameters in those four simple equations creates a whole industry in which the thousands, probably, I think it is, of PhDs in mathematical economics churned out by universities around the world each year. You can write articles, do PhDs, get tenure, get jobs in central banks, who are the biggest employers of these people. And it has been to the benefit of the nomenclatura, and it has been to the massive disadvantage both of capitalism and democracy and of freedom. And it's that intellectual failure, I think, come back to your question, which you asked about 20 minutes ago, Richard, sorry it's taking so long. That intellectual failure is at the heart of what's gone wrong in the world economically, financially, and politically over the past 25 years. There are lots of other things as well, and we could spend a whole day discussing the malign impact of woke, for instance, but let's not get onto that for now. Let's stick with the economics part of it.
Yeah, no, that's great and very interesting, very insightful. Just sorry, we're running up to a time constraint here. Your final thoughts, Ira, on?
I have, you know, Bernard really sums it up so beautifully, and people will go who will listen to this, because again, you know, we come, who's our audience here? Well, certainly people like me, as much as I theoretically would love to deal with this, I'm at the end of the day a trader, and how do I put this into action? How is it gonna get me, you know, to fit into the Lacey Hunt, Rosenberg, into the bond market? So, I mean, this will, I think, needs a part two. And then most importantly, I think, you know, from my perspective, is what we do with the precious metals and cryptocurrencies is now a new dynamic in looking upon the failure of fiat currency. Because as Bernard points out, when central banks take this and they fail, it calls into question the credibility of central banks. And the credibility of central banks is critical in a fiat currency world, because there is nothing else that stands behind it except the credibility and political standing of the political institutions, and of course, central banks being a part of the political institutions as much as they want to want to yell that they're independent, it's still a part of that. And how we deal with that is where, because if Bernard is correct, and I think if you go back and people would read the original Rotten Heart of Europe, it's just not about the politics of Europe, it's so much more about the global economy and things that Bernard has written in numerous journals over the years. It is correct. Now, how do we avail of ourselves to it to make profits? That's probably ready for part two, but it'll be in the bond markets. And we haven't heard Bernard talk. We haven't had any discussion about the crypto, but that is to come, because it's all a statement about what people see as that response to central banks and their failing credibility. And it is failing, because how do they take it back? In order to reestablish their credibility, and it was interesting, we can go back to yesterday with Rafael Bostic from the Atlanta Fed, of all people, talking about the need to start quantitative tightening at $100 billion a month. Well, the balance sheet is so big now, we don't know any of the Fed doesn't know either. And that's what Powell keeps alluding to. Well, you know, we have the tools, right? We have the tools. To me, the worst tool, and I keep coming in, Bernard talks about Woodford, is this concept of forward guidance. Forward guidance has been a disaster because it keeps painting them into a corner because they don't want to disappoint markets. And that's ultimately, well, don't worry about disappointing markets. I still will say that the worst action was Ben Bernanke's taper tantrum. Instead of letting markets absorb the losses that Bernard so eloquently talked about before, because you need to have investors absorb losses in order to train them how to best allocate their money. But there is none of that. And as soon as Bernanke pivoted away from that and panicked, but that's, you know, that's the problem of the academic world. Theoretically, it's a good idea. In practicality, it's not such a, it may not work out that way. Or as Bernard, then stochastics are actually good, because given time, the markets will right themselves if you allow them to take the hit. As, you know, as Deng Xiaoping so famously said, practice is the sole criterion for judging truth. Well, I believe in praxis, which is what that's about. You must, and you have to allow things. You can't just endow yourself with the headlines. That's the world we live in. Algorithms drive headlines. Headlines are written to drive algorithms. It's a really a vicious circle, and I see it and feel the pain of it as a trader on a regular basis. But that's the world in which we live in. And so Bernard sets the table so beautifully as to how anybody who's looking to be a quality investor needs these issues to think about as to where we're going to go.
Great.
Can I just add one thing, Richard, if you forgive me?
Yep, I can.
I entirely agree with Ira that traders have got to learn how to take losses. The bets can go wrong. That much of wealth is illusory. The debts do have to be repaid. The corollary of that is that we're now in a position where allowing that to happen, I think it probably has to be allowed to happen, must involve a substantial recession, a substantial economic recession. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is sort of at the back of Powell's mind. Not this year, probably not next year, but thereafter, you know, once all the excess savings and the fiscal boost has faded away, we're back into this position where to prevent a recession, you've got to keep pumping things out. You've either got to have lower interest rates or bigger budget deficits. And if you want to get out of that, you're going to have to accept a potentially quite deep recession. And will central banks in general be prepared to do that? The ECB, certainly not, I think. The Bank of Japan, no, it's shown that over almost 30 years now. I mean, they've had recessions, but the Bank of Japan has always tried to avoid them, to modify them, to reverse them. Will the Fed? And this is where IRA's concern about central bank credibility is absolutely the key thing. Will the Fed do what it says and avoid the entrenching of inflation expectations? Reading the minutes of the last FOMC meeting don't give me a great deal of confidence on that point, or the statement for that matter, where it said that at or above our inflation target, but we'll keep interest rates at zero. But it does, I think, give one not a great deal of confidence in the Fed's determination to avoid entrenching inflation expectations. Inflation expectations get going, then the choice becomes even starker. And it's bad enough already. If you want to reverse that entrenching, then you're going to have a very severe recession. And I'm afraid that's where we stand. So from a trader's point of view, I'm not trying to teach my grandmother to suck eggs. I never dream of doing that.
No, that's the...
You're quite right. It's, it comes down, which way does the Fed jump? I mean, there's no way of getting around that.
Yeah. You know, Bernard, and you, this will, I know, hopefully we'll do another one of these. And it gets, and when you read the minutes, and you know that the politicians are concerned with headline inflation. So I found it astounding over the weekend that Jason Furman, who was Council of Economic Advisors in the Obama administration, and is certainly no hawk, but when he comes out and makes a statement that he's concerned about we don't know who the Biden White House is going to put forth. Now there's four openings on the FOMC mm-hmm. board, but the three that were leaked last week, and they're leaked, and or what we used to call trial wounds, which was, you know, of course, Sarah Raskin, who we do know because she was already on the board, mm-hmm. but the other two, Philip Jefferson and Lisa Cook, these are a group of, their academic credentials are fine, but they certainly lean very dovish because they're labor economists, and labor economists are synonymous with, well, what's good for wages and for the employment situation. And so you may be concerned with headline inflation, but your appointees, and Jason Furman said these, the exact quote was that these would be the most dovish people in many, many years to sit on. So I, you know what, you have to watch carefully, and this does set the table as to how do we look about this in its aggregate. So that'll be the next one, I think.
For the next time, and those are the big questions. Thank you so much, Bernard and Ira, for this interesting discussion. It's been very insightful with awesome perspective. Thank you. And
well, thank you very much for setting the time, Richard.
Bernard, it is, as always, this is better than Starbucks, because I have a view of mountains rather than mountains of trash. And I hope you're well, and hopefully we'll start connecting back. And thank you for everything. Yes.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.